Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
My home is not on this earth, not in this world.
So, the plan today, we're back in our 1 Corinthians series. We were there for quite a while. Then we had a little pause. We spent a few weeks looking at an Old Testament story called Ruth. We finished that last week. So we're back to 1 Corinthians. And we're going to jump back into it on what I think is like the hardest bit of 1 Corinthians. And I know there are people in this church who thought that we only did Ruth because we'd come to a tricky bit of 1 Corinthians. But that's not true. We're going to tackle it head on tonight. Let me just kind of set the scene again. So 1 Corinthians is a letter. It's written by Paul. He was commissioned by Jesus to go around the Gentile, that's the non-Jewish world, tell people the gospel. See, churches started in different cities. One of those cities was Corinth. So Paul turned up there with a small team. They saw a bunch of people there give their lives to Jesus. Over the course of about a year and a half, they got a church formed. And then Paul had to leave to go on to the next place. But he was still involved with this church, and they were corresponding back and forth. He was like a father figure to them. Now, 1 Corinthians is one of the letters that he wrote. And this church has got itself into a little bit of a mess in a number of different ways. So, as I say, we're going to be in a tricky passage. It's 1 Corinthians 11. Now, you might wonder why we don't just skip it because it's awkward. Well, that's really because we have a conviction that the Bible is the inspired word of God. That every word in the Bible is profitable, is helpful, and that it's worth pushing through stuff, even if we don't get it at first, because God wants to bless us through it. I truly believe that. What it does mean, though, is you need to engage your brain. So if you've got like a bag of sweets with you, I think all the sugar in those sweets, you're going to need it to stay focused tonight. That's just a little warning. Let's read it, and then we can have a little chat about it. So 1 Corinthians chapter 11, today's passage is verses 2 to 16. Now, I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions, even as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it's the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it's disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. This is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it's a disgrace for him, but if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, for her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. Right, that is our passage for tonight. Why is this such a challenging passage to think about? I'm going to give you 5 reasons why I think that this is difficult for us. Number one is it approaches a topic which is a bit of a cultural sore spot. Okay, so men, women, the relationship between the two. It's a hot issue in culture. I don't know if any of you saw a year and a bit ago that interview that Jordan Peterson did on Channel 4 News. And he started sharing some opinions about this. And I'm not saying that his opinions match the Bible's opinions, but the fact that there was an interview where someone was talking about this, you could see the reaction to it. It's like a bomb was dropped. This is a hot issue in culture. So it's hard for that reason. Second reason it's hard, though, is the more specific question that it's trying to address is a long way removed from our culture. So it's talking about head covering, it's talking about worship. Now, I can think of parts of the world where that would be a live issue. A lot of people would be asking those kind of questions. We're in the West, in Manchester, in the 21st century. I've never heard anyone ask me this question. It just isn't on our minds, in culture, in our churches, or anything like that. That's the second reason. Third reason I think this is hard is we might start to feel a bit uncomfortable when we read it about what it's going to ask us to do. I mean, I don't know if any of you are wondering if, like, behind here I've got some, like, headscarves that I'm going to, like, hand out at the end of the sermon or anything like that. But we're a bit worried that if we read it and if we think it means a certain thing, what will that make us do? Because if we want to obey the Bible, then we want to obey it in whatever it says, don't we? Fourth one, I think this for me is one of the really kind of key issues why this is a hard passage. It's really hard to understand what he's saying. Like, the logic is difficult. He seems to be saying some things that sort of contradict each other. So early on in the passage, he talks about, like, a woman shouldn't have her hair on display. And then later on, he's saying, look, her long hair is her glory. She doesn't need to have it covered up. It feels like a contradiction. Or are men from women? It seems to be saying no, then it seems to be saying yes. It feels like it's muddled. It doesn't seem to be very coherent. So how should we know what to think? And then the final reason I think this is a difficult passage is that it's half a conversation. Now, I tend to travel into the city centre on the Met, and you get people, I think this is rude, don't ever do this if you're on the Met, but they're on their phone, and everyone else who's trying to, like, read or zone out into their headphones or whatever has to hear their conversation. And you don't even get the full conversation. You only get half a conversation. So someone's trying to, like, make a business deal. And when that happens, I just play the, I'm going to guess what the other person's just said game, and try and reconstruct a conversation from only having half of it. Well, that's what we have here. We have half a conversation. Paul is in dialogue with this church in Corinth. And he's actually, in this section of the letter, responding to things that they have written to him about. So in chapter 7, verse 1, he says, now, concerning the issues about which you wrote, and then everything that comes up after, is his responses to their questions. He also says in verse 2 of our passage this evening, I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. So it seems like Paul said some stuff to them when he was there. They've written back to him with their thoughts on it, and this is his reply. So this is like stage 3 in a dialogue. The other thing that we've seen happen in most of the passages where Paul responds is he quotes a bit of what they've said to him. So if you just scan up a few verses into, say, chapter 10, verse 23, he says, all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. And we think that all things are lawful is picking out a little bit of what they've said, and then he's arguing back. So you have to ask the question, well, does that happen here? In our verses, is any of what we've read him quoting them and then going on to answer it? Because if that was the case, it kind of makes sense why it's a bit muddled, why it says one thing, but then unpicks it and says something else if it's a quote and then a response. However, okay, ancient literature, they didn't have quotation marks, so you've got to try and reconstruct it a bit yourself. The best way to do it is look for words that feel like they're gear change words. So if you see something, and then the word but, and then what comes after it is different, that's a gear change, or in response. And the word in this passage, I think, is the key one. I don't know if you noticed it in verse 11. Now, I've made it smaller writing so you can see it all in one go. It's the word nevertheless. So here's a bunch of stuff. Right, I hear that. Nevertheless, here's a bunch of other stuff. And this stuff after the nevertheless seems to argue against what's above it. So I strongly believe this passage is structured in that way. You've got some stuff that they've said and his response to it. Can I just get the next one? This is the breakdown, I believe. So verse 2 is kind of Paul's introduction. So he's saying, we're going to talk about the traditions now. This is what you do when you gather together as a church. And he said, I commend you. This is really a backhanded compliment, because everything he says from now on, he's telling them off about it. So it isn't much of a commendation, but he's trying to kind of just be warm as he introduces it. I think verse 3 is kind of the essence of what Paul said to them when he was there. And there are 3 statements. And I think the Corinthians have only really understood one of the 3. Okay, they've taken the middle one. The head of a wife is her husband. And they've taken it in a bad direction. Now, the Bible does talk about headship in the family, and that's a sermon for another day. But they kind of got this lodged in their head, and they thought, well, because there's something of that, and kind of this is a biblical truth, we need to make it really hard line. And when people gather together to worship, we need to really make everything kind of directed by this. Paul brings in two other statements now as a bit of a corrective. First one is that the head of every man is Christ. So the idea is that the shape of a marriage, so a man and a woman together, is meant to reflect the relationship between Jesus and his people. So don't think about like dominating or being in charge. Think about sacrificing and serving. That's what Jesus did for his people. And that's meant to be the shape of a marriage relationship. There's a sermon we did a few months ago on this, and it's available online. And then he says as well, the head of Christ is God. So he brings it into the Trinity. He says, don't you dare think about this in a way that like makes one better or worse, or kind of exalts one and pushes one down. The relationships between humans are meant to mirror the relationships in the Trinity for God himself. So if Paul said something like that to them when he was there, they've then got a bit of a hardline case that they want to take from it, about propriety of dress in gathered worship. Here are their ideas, okay? These are the Corinthian ideas, not mine, so don't shout at me if I say some of these, because they're not great ideas, okay? First thing they suggest is that a man should not cover his head to pray or prophesy. So a man wearing a hat shouldn't pray or prophesy, because that would dishonor his head. And a woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered, so if she's not got like a scarf or a shawl or a hat or something over her hair as she prays or prophesies, this would dishonor her head. And then they kind of rationalize it a bit, said, look, if she's not going to do that, she might as well just shave her whole hair off, and that would be disgraceful, so she can't do that. And they're kind of getting themselves wrapped up in this thing. But the big issue for them seems to be a woman praying or prophesying with her hair uncovered. Now, why in the world would that be a big deal for them, you may ask? Possibly there were some cultural connotations around it. Some of the commentators would say, maybe stuff connected with prostitution, maybe stuff like... In that culture, basically, husbands were allowed to sleep around. There was a movement called the Liberated Wives, where they were saying, look, we should be allowed to sleep around as well. And to show that we're on board with this, we're going to walk around with our hair uncovered. Perhaps people messing around with gender roles. There's all sorts of stuff in the culture. But whatever the cultural context, the Corinthian church have made these rules of engagement for their worship services. And then what they do, they go a step further. They try and get some theology to back it up. Now, bad ideas are one thing. Bad ideas that you then try and theologize, they're just annoying. Okay, they really are. They ground their theology in the creation story. Now, that's a good way to do theology. Okay? I quite often, when I'm teaching on a topic, I look at what does creation have to teach about it? They're just doing it really badly. So some of the things they say, right? They say this. They say that man is the image and glory of God, and that woman is the glory of man. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? Does that grate on you? It should do. It should grate on you a bit. Have you read Genesis? Anyone ever read the creation story? Because my Bible doesn't say that. It doesn't say man is the image of God and woman is the image and glory of man. It doesn't say that at all. It says God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Male and female, humanity is in the image of God. Next statement they make is that man was not made from woman, but woman from man. So again, they look at the story. They say, okay, there was Adam. And Eve was taken from his rib. And so, oh, she came from him. That must imply something about the relationship between the two. And thirdly, they say, neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. So again, they're saying, look, Adam was there. He had to work all the garden. He needed a helper. None of the animals were suitable. And so Eve was made to be his helper. So their position, verse 10, they sum it up. They're basically saying, look, we've read Genesis. We've reached all these conclusions about men and women and authority. We want this to be symbolized in our worship. And it needs to be symbolized with the head coverings. Then randomly they talk about the angels, and no commentator knows what's going on there. It seems a bit of a red herring, probably tied into like non-biblical Jewish literature of the day. However, that is their case. Now, I'm a bit ready for this nevertheless. Okay, nevertheless is going to be an important word for us today. Here's Paul's response. So let's see what he has to say about this. Now, he starts with the theology, because they've tried to justify their ideas based on their theology. He needs to correct their theology before he can correct their ideas. So his response is, look, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. So they were saying, look, woman was made for man, but man wasn't made for woman, as though kind of man is kind of the key one and woman is derivative. But Paul is saying, no, both men and women need each other. We're not independent of one another. You could say there's an interdependence. Okay? Men and women created by God to come together as his people. He also says, for as woman was made from man, so now man is born of woman. So they were saying, look, men don't really come from women, do they? And Paul said, just think about that one a second, okay? Now, I remember 6 and a bit years ago, my firstborn son was born, okay, Sam. He's a little man, right? I can imagine trying, like, maybe an hour after the birth, kind of going to Emma and say, right, let's just kind of clarify how this works, right? Woman came from man, but no man has ever come from a woman. And she'd be like, there's a little man there who just kind of came from me. And this is what Paul is trying to say. Okay, Eve came from Adam, but every man who has ever lived since has come from woman. And then just to kind of tie it all up, he says, and all things are from God. So yes, woman comes from man, and yes, man comes from woman, and we all come from God. Do you see how he's trying to put us all on an equal footing? He's not trying to kind of have one exalted above the other. He's trying to have both from God. Ultimately, that's where we're all from. So he's challenged their theology. He's now going to challenge their practice a little bit. Because he asks them a question. Based on what I've said, right, judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Now, given that he's just kind of undercut all the foundations of their theology on which they were saying a wife shouldn't do this, it would be fair to expect the answer to this question to change. You say, yes, of course it's proper for her to pray to God with her head uncovered. And in the next verse, it confirms it. He says, if a woman has long hair, it's her glory. Her hair is given to her as a covering. He says, it's fine. Her hair before God is absolutely fine. That whole verse, though, verse 14, that sounds like a weird verse, doesn't it? I read that a few times, like quite a lot of times as I was preparing this, trying to figure out, what's going on there? He's saying nature teaches that men with long hair and women with short hair, that's a disgrace. What's that all about? As I've read into it, the word nature, don't think like kind of creation, walking the woodlands kind of nature. He's talking nature in the sense of the way things tend to be. Okay, go out on the street in Corinth, have a look around, see how most people do things. Probably true in Manchester as well. Not everybody by any means, but for most people, this is the way things tend to be. So he said, look, why are you getting so worried about women having their hair covered, their head covered? Most women have long hair, their head's covered anyway. Why are you so worried about men not having their hair covered? Most men don't have much hair. I certainly don't. Looking around this room, many of the other men are in the same situation. He's trying to say, don't make a big deal of it. That's what he's trying to say. I don't think he's trying to be prescriptive at all. I don't think he's trying to tell people how they should cut their hair. Actually, I think he's been a little bit playful and ironic. Okay, we never really see the humour in the Bible. But you've got to remember, right, when Paul went to Corinth, he'd taken something called a Nazarite vow. And this was a vow to do certain things as a symbol of his devotion to God. One of the rules of a Nazarite vow was you're not allowed to cut your hair. So Paul, as this church planter in Corinth who started this church, would have had long hair. So as he's kind of writing this, hey, don't you know that it's a disgrace for a bloke to have long hair? I think he's trying to rib them a bit. I think he's trying to poke them and get a reaction. Maybe even when he was there, some of them gave him a bit of stick about his hair, and now he's teasing them. I don't know. But he finishes up. I love verse 16. I really do. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, I mean, who would ever be contentious about this stuff? It never happens, does it? But if anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. He's saying, look, this isn't something we do. It's not something any of the other churches do either. So stop it, Corinthians. You shouldn't be doing it either. That's what I think is going on in this passage. Okay. That was the brain bit. What I want to do with the time that we've got left, because if we go away thinking, I think I understand which bit of 1 Corinthians 11 was a quote, that would be kind of a poor return for an hour spent in church. Let's see what we can learn from it. I want to share a few reflections for life based on what's happened here. First one is this. We need to know this. We need to celebrate this and dignify it. Both men and women are image bearers of God. Okay, we need to have that deep in our psyche. The verse again, Genesis 1:27. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. If we truly understand this, and if we truly dignify men as the image of God and women as the image of God, that will undercut so much of what is destructive in our society. Frances Willard was an American, the only woman with a statue in the National Statuary Hall in the 19th century. She'd spent a lot of time studying about the image of God, reflecting on it. She gave her life to fighting for several things. Two of the key ones were rights for African Americans and votes for women. Because she understood the image of God in all people, she was able to fight to put right some of the evils in society. Aung San Suu Kyi said, in societies where men are truly confident of their own worth, women are not merely tolerated, but valued. But where do we get that from? Where do we get that confidence in the worth of men and of women? Now, Aung San Suu Kyi is not a believer, but truly to get that, it comes from seeing the image of God. So we need to understand it in the way we see ourselves and in the way we see each other. And the way we interact with one another in our workplace. I mean, do you ever feel like there are people who somehow you treat differently or treat as lesser based on their gender? In our relationships in the church, in our friendship circles, in the way we joke, do we ever make men or women the butt of our jokes? The image of God needs to be affirmed and dignified in both. Secondly, I think we can learn then, is that maleness and femaleness are God's idea. Paul's clear that there's a distinction between the two. And it images the Trinity. When Eve was made for Adam, the literal word was kenegdo, which means one who's like and opposite him. So like, opposite. So she's like him. She has the same dignity, the same image of God. But she's opposite. She's female. She's not male. And you can affirm this on a biological level, a neurological level, a physiological level. Men and women are different. And sometimes it seems like that truth can be chipped away a little bit in the world around us. James Damore was fired from Google in 2017 for suggesting there were physiological differences between men and women. But I want to say to you this evening, your maleness or your femaleness is given to you by God. It's God's idea and it's God's design. And I want to affirm you in that. I want to affirm you tonight as a man. I want to affirm you tonight as a woman, as who you are, who God has made you to be. You can be confident in that. And just to say as well, don't hear from that kind of like a narrow, like cultural version of that. So saying I affirm you as a man doesn't mean you need to like start liking rugby and eating curry. To say I affirm you as a woman doesn't mean you need to start painting your fingernails and drinking tea from little cups. It's not that. It's not that. It's something bigger, but there's something God-given at the heart of it that I'd want to affirm. Third thing then that I'd want to say to you as an application from this, men and women need each other. If Paul says that men and women are not independent, it means we truly do need each other. So take, for instance, if you've got a decision to make and there's a team of you. I mean, I know I've been in situations in a workplace where I've had to make a decision. I've kind of got one or two male colleagues around me. We've talked about it. We've come up with what seems like a brilliant idea. Then we kind of widen the group discussion, get a couple of girls on the team as well. And all of a sudden we realize what a bad idea our original idea was. There's a different perspective that can sometimes come. We need one another. You know, when you're asking for advice, when you've got a life decision to make, who do you ask for advice from? I would suggest it's a good idea to ask advice from people of both genders, get different perspectives into the mix. When you think about your friendships, who are you friends with? Who's your friendship circle? I would suggest you need both men and women as part of your friendship circle to speak into your life. Certainly this speaks into marriage. If you're married, you need each other in your marriage. Actually, I think for society to flourish, we need to get the best out of men and women together to make it happen. Fourth application then is this: men and women are both needed in our gathered worship. Because that was the context of our passage. The expectation is, as we come together, people will be praying, people will be prophesying, that both men and women will be participating. And Paul wants to make it easy for that to happen. So do I. I believe everyone in this room has been given a manifestation of the Holy Spirit for the common good. God's put stuff in you to bless the church. And we want to be blessed by it. We want you to bring what you have to bring. So think about how to end this message. I didn't know, so I thought I'd best apply some of this advice. So yesterday I was in the car chatting with Emma about the sermon and where we're going and kind of what to say. The conversation got on to, what does it look like when this isn't the case, when this is done badly? And Emma was telling me one time she was in a different country. She was traveling with like a female friend from uni. They met a British couple there who they were getting on well with. They were walking through the streets. So these two female students and a married couple. And one of the locals came and asked the man from this couple how many goats he wanted for one of his wives. And that's one extreme example. It's easy to give an extreme example from a culture that's very different to our own. In our culture, there are so many examples as well. I don't know if you've heard of Carly Fiorina. She was one of the presidential candidates in America last time around. From the business world, she was the CEO of Hewlett-Packard. But she talks about, as she first became a partner in that business, there was a client meeting. And the clients were her clients, but also her boss's clients. They shared them. And her boss set up the meeting in a strip club, thinking that if they put the meeting there, she wouldn't possibly go. So she wouldn't have a voice with the client, so she would be edged out of the business. That kind of thing happens all too often in companies in our culture. That's what it's like. I can think of an example for myself. When Emma was pregnant and we were going to the hospital for all the meetings, all the scans, I remember as I'd ask a question, the looks that I got, it's like, it felt like people were looking at me in such a way, why are you speaking? What have you got to do with this? I felt like I didn't belong, like I wasn't wanted. Now, I'm not at all suggesting my experience at all compares to Carly Fiorina's or Emma's, but I know how I felt when it did. And that just gives me a small window of insight into how it must feel for the many, many examples of this happening all around us all the time. Getting this right matters. It's really important. The last thing I would want is there to be people here or out there feeling like they don't fit, like they can't bring the unique contribution God has given them